Good evening. Good to see everyone tonight. Tonight brings us to the thrilling conclusion of the book of Daniel, chapters 11 and 12. This is challenging stuff to really get through and come away with feeling like, you know, you really clearly understand all of this, I have to say. If you're like me, the first time you kind of read through some of this, it's a head scratcher. So, last week, you know, we went through chapters 9 and 10, and just noticed that chapter 10 really is kind of the lead-in introduction now into what we're going to be getting into chapters 11 and 12, this vision that is revealed to Daniel. And as we do that, I do think that it is really important to understand that what we're going to be looking at in these two chapters and what's revealed to him is what's described in chapter 10 is what's inscribed in the writing of truth. And that really, you know, I think chapter 10 of verse 14 is the key to this whole thing, that God is revealing to Daniel what's going to happen to Daniel's people, to your people, he says, in the latter days, for the vision pertains to days yet future. So the purpose of all that's being revealed to Daniel in this vision really pertains to what's going to happen to the Jews in the coming centuries of history. And so we stand now at the perspective that we have, you know, thousands of years later, and we can look back on this period of time that was foretold to Daniel and take a look at it from what we know from history. So there's, you know, if you did the reading, there's just a ton of detail in this vision that is provided to Daniel. And, you know, Daniel at the end, he's told to write it down, preserve it. Did you think maybe about why there's all this detail that's given in this vision? I mean, it's certainly interesting to read through, but it's not like any of the other prophecies, really. This is a very unique revelation from God to Daniel. You know, a thought that I had was that there's just so much detail provided about this, you know, from Daniel's perspective, this coming period of history, that the Jews, by the time of the coming of the Messiah, should have readily been able to look back through history, this time that we were sometimes referred to as the period between the Testaments, right? Between the time of when really the last revelation was given to, you know, through Malachi, and really the rebuilding of the temple to the arrival of Jesus, the Messiah, you know, they should have been able to look at all this vision and the revelation of it and match it up against history, which they themselves were much closer to than we are. And should have been instructive to them to recognize that they were living in the time of the Messiah. And then when Jesus arrived and began teaching about the kingdom and claiming to be the Messiah who he is, they you know, really had no excuse for rejecting him, given the prophecy and the revelation that was given to Daniel, as well as all of the other prophecies as well. But this really just, in my mind, kind of caps it off. So let's go ahead and get right into it. Chapter 11, the first four verses talk about some world kingdoms. And keep in mind, the timing of this vision is in the third year of Cyrus. So he's already issued his decree for the Jews to return to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple and to rebuild their city. And what are the world kingdoms or empires that Daniel is informed about here? Right. So certainly there's the Medo-Persian Empire, which Daniel is in at the moment when he receives this revelation, and he's, you know, under the reign of Cyrus. And then he's told something interesting. He's told that there would be three more kings that would arise within this particular kingdom. And we just know kind of from looking back in history that these were, but their names Cambyses, Smerdis, and then there's a Darius Hystaspes, actually, who followed Cyrus in the Medo-Persian Empire. And then Daniel is told that there would be a fourth, you know, yet a fourth king who would arise, who would gain far more riches than those who had preceded him, and this would be Xerxes, really the final king of the Medo-Persian empire. And then there would be this great conflict then between the Medo-Persian empire and the kingdom of Greece, and that a great king would arise with great authority, and we know that to have been Alexander the Great. And then verses 5 through 19 then talk about this period of history, really between, it occurs between Alexander the Great and the Roman Empire. And we've mentioned this before, but, you know, following Alexander the Great, he established his kingdom extremely fast over the course of just really about 10 years or so. And then he died. He died in his early 30s. And there were, he had 12 generals when he was carrying out his campaign and establishing his kingdom. Four of those emerged after Alexander the Great to really essentially take over four parts of the kingdom of the empire that Alexander the Great had established. And so, you know, there's not a whole lot devoted to these, you know, Lysimachus and Cassander. But then there was Seleucus, who basically took over the northern part of the Greek Empire, and then Ptolemy down in Egypt. So you're right, Larry. These are the two empires now that Daniel is being, you know, given some information about. And this really goes back to, you know, the previous revelations that have been given to Daniel. You know, there's the image really that was revealed to Nebuchadnezzar. And we looked at this weeks ago, and there's the four different parts of this image that correspond to four different kingdoms. And in Daniel's told there's going to be four kingdoms, and Daniel interprets that dream for Nebuchadnezzar. And then later on in chapter 7, we look at a similar vision that Daniel is given of the four beasts, which really correspond to, you know, those same four kingdoms. And then in chapter 8, we're able to drill in and focus a little bit more into these two kingdoms, Medo-Persia and Greece, with the vision of the ram and of the male goat. So for purposes of this vision now, the remainder of it, for the most part, it really focuses around these two successors of Alexander the Great in the Greek Empire. So Seleucus in the north and Ptolemy in the south. And so as we're reading, you know, the king of the north did this and the king of the south did this, those are fairly generic terms relating to the conflict, really, that would just be ongoing as you read through this between these two kings. Make sense? Any questions so far on any of that? That's, you know, it fits in, and it kind of matches up with some of what we've been through already in some of these other revelations. So then we get into, really, in verse 5 in chapter 11, we start with all of this activity between the kings of the north and the kings of the south. And as I said, you know, starting out, there really is a lot of detail that is given to this. And so, you know, I don't know that we'll spend a whole lot of time going through this, but it is, you know, it's instructive to look at this and to see how closely, you know, history really, the history that we know about during this period really does in fact match up with this vision and this prophecy that was revealed to Daniel. And it's really very faith building to look at this. And so we'll go through some of this, which is probably barely legible. No, not too bad with the new paint job that we have on the wall, thanks to Bill. So what I've done here is I've just kind of laid out. So on the left side of is here's what the prophecy said. On the right, and if you're like me, this is a period of history that I'm less familiar with. You know, you study the Bible and you get familiar with the period of the patriarchs and the period of the Israelites and all of this. And then you come into and then, of course, in the New Testament, right, the Roman Empire and the history of the church and so forth. There is this period that, you know, frankly, I am a little bit less familiar with. I'm certainly not an expert in any of this. Nevertheless, just looking at this, and it gets confusing because so many of the names are repeated. There's various Seleucus, individuals named Seleucus, and there's various individuals with the name Ptolemy. But really think of those as two different dynasties that existed during this period. And so it starts off with the king of the south will grow strong. So that's talking about Ptolemy. And along with one of his princes, really one of Alexander's princes, who will gain ascendancy over him. And so Ptolemy in the south was a powerful king, but Seleucus in the north really was, in fact, more powerful than Ptolemy. And then after some years, they would form an alliance between these two kings. And in fact, 35 years after the death of Seleucus, a Ptolemy Philadelphus, and Antiochus, who's a name that you see in the northern part then. So Ptolemy again is in the south, Antiochus in the north. Now we're talking about Antiochus II, a successor of Seleucus. They did, in fact, form an alliance. And they did that by Ptolemy offering his daughter Berenice to Antiochus in the north. And so there was a political marriage. The problem with that, in read verse 6, she, this daughter of Ptolemy, will not retain her position of power, nor will she remain in power. So you can see there's this alliance that forms, but something's going to happen to this daughter. And in fact, Ptolemy offered his daughter Berenice to Antiochus II. The problem was he was already married to a woman named Laodice. And so he divorces Laodice. He marries Berenice. 2 years later, however, Ptolemy in Egypt dies. So Berenice's father dies. And when that happened, Antiochus divorces Berenice and takes back Laodice. And then Laodice actually poisons Antiochus II and encourages her son, who is this Seleucus Callinicus, to then murder Berenice and her infant son. So you see there's just all of this intrigue and this conflict going on, which is, you know, what's being described throughout these prophecies. Then, you know, verse 7 talks about one of the descendants of her line. So this is a descendant within Berenice's family, would arise in his place and will come against their army and enter the fortress of the king of the north. So Berenice had a brother, this Ptolemy Euergetes, and, you know, so he goes up basically to avenge the murder of his sister. And so he kills Laodice. And then verse 9, then the king of the north, it refers to him as the latter, if we do all the reading through there. But the latter will enter the realm of the king of the south, but just return to his own land. So 2 years after this happened, where Ptolemy Euergetes had gone up to kill Laodice, then Seleucus Callinicus, who's in the north, he regains his strength and he marches down to Egypt, but he is soundly defeated and he just returns back to the north. So it's just, you know, it's interesting just to kind of see how all of this actual history just really lines up very closely with the prophecy. There's more. So the king of the north's sons mobilize a multitude, a great army. So there were two sons of Antiochus II, who by now has been killed. Those two sons were Seleucus Seranus and Antiochus the Great. And Antiochus the Great, we'll read quite a bit, actually, about his exploits throughout this description. They mobilize a great army. Seleucus Seranus actually dies early in this campaign. And so it's really Antiochus the Great then who proceeds and he wages war against Egypt. And this war between, you know, the northern kingdom and Egypt really just continues on for years. So Antiochus the Great comes down. He wages war against Egypt. The king of the south then becomes enraged against the king of the north. And the king of the north raises a great multitude. But it will be given into the hand of the king of the south. So at the attempt of Antiochus the Great to go down and wage war against Egypt and conquer him, Ptolemy Philopater became enraged against Antiochus the Great, and he actually defeats Antiochus the Great at a place called Raphia. However, that Ptolemy didn't really press his advantage and completely wipe out and destroy him. This Ptolemy just, he defeated Antiochus the Great, goes back to Egypt, kind of lives out his days in luxury. That allows Antiochus the Great to kind of regain his strength. And so 13 years later, he actually does go back down and wages war against Egypt again. By this time, that Ptolemy that had been there before had actually died, and now his son is in his place, who is a Ptolemy Epiphanes, but he's only a child at this time. So Antiochus the Great then is actually successful, and we see, you know, that's described there in verse 13, that the king of the north will again raise a greater multitude even than the former army that he had, and he goes down after some years with this great multitude. We're not going to do this all night, I promise. There's just two more slides and then we'll move on. But so then verse 14, in those times, many will rise up against the king of the south, and the violent ones among your people will also lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision, but they will fall down. So there was this alliance that occurred between Antiochus the Great and Philip of Macedon, and along with certain rebels within Egypt and certain Jews within Palestine itself, to really try to overthrow this Ptolemy Epiphanes, who was there at that time. And then it says the king of the north, verse 15, will come down and will set up a siege ramp and will capture a well-fortified city. So Antiochus the Great does come down and he captures Sidon, where Ptolemy Epiphanes had sent one of his ablest generals, Scopas, to retake territory that Ptolemy had lost to Antiochus the Great. But Antiochus the Great actually defeats Scopas there at Sidon. And so then verses 16 through 17 describe Antiochus the Great. He will come. He will do as he pleases. No one will be able to withstand him. He will stay for a time in the beautiful land with destruction in his hand. He will set his face to come with the power of his whole kingdom, and bringing with him a proposal of peace, which he will put into effect. He will also give him the daughter of women to ruin it, but she will not take a stand for him or be on his side. And so what happens here is that Antiochus the Great does form an alliance with Ptolemy after Ptolemy's surrender. And it is so they form a treaty, and Antiochus the Great gave Ptolemy Epiphanes his daughter Cleopatra to be his wife. And there's all of this intrigue, and Antiochus the Great is and Ptolemy Epiphanes are lying to each other and deceiving each other constantly. What's interesting, Antiochus the Great gives his daughter to Ptolemy Epiphanes to be his wife, presumably to kind of be an insider and to help bring about Ptolemy's downfall. But Antiochus's daughter Cleopatra actually sides with her husband, Ptolemy Epiphanes, and so Antiochus the Great is kind of thwarted in his attempts to overthrow Ptolemy Epiphanes. Last slide, I promise. So then he will turn his face to the coastlands and capture many, but a commander will put a stop to him. So Antiochus the Great, he was unable to overthrow Ptolemy Epiphanes, and he turns his attention to the coastlands of the Mediterranean, even as far as Asia Minor. But there is a Roman official. So Lucius Scipio Asiaticus comes and he actually defeats Antiochus the Great to put a stop to Antiochus's efforts. And really, he no longer is even a factor in world events anymore at that point in time. So then in his place, so in Antiochus the Great's place, one will arise who will send an oppressor through the jewel of his kingdom. So the successor to Antiochus the Great, king of the north, was this Seleucus Philopater. And he sends a tax collector and prime minister by the name of Heliodorus through the land of the Jews. And then somehow, mysteriously, Seleucus Philopater just suddenly kind of just disappears and is removed. And so you see in the prophecy there, yet with a few days he'll be shattered, though not in anger nor in battle. And the conclusion seems to be that this Heliodorus, this prime minister, actually poisoned this Seleucus Philopater. And then we get to verse 21, and we're told that in his place, so in Seleucus fill a pater's place, this despicable person will arise, which this description now goes on for several verses, and it really aptly describes Antiochus Epiphanes in history. So, you know, the point of all of this is not, you know, a history lesson per se, but it is, I think, helpful to just see, you know, it's one thing to just read all this prophecy and just kind of scratch your head and what is this talking about? But it's really helpful, at least it was, you know, it is for me to do a little bit of history research and actually see how this all really matches up with the prophecy. I think it's faith building. I'm sure that Daniel, you know, must have just really wondered how all this was going to play out exactly and affect his people. But I do think it's faith building for us to see this. And I do think that it would have been instructive and helpful to the Jews, certainly at the time of the Messiah, to have known about all this, you know, from their perspective, much more recent history than it is for us, and would have helped them to understand the times they were in and that the destruction of the temple, which a lot of us is going to talk about now, really was imminent. So I know it's a lot and it's a lot of me talking, but I thought that would be interesting and kind of helpful to go through some of that. So we get to this character, Antiochus Epiphanes, who we may be more familiar with. He, you know, it's described here certainly as despicable. And these verses 21 through 20 through really through 35 of chapter 11 really describe, you know, his activities. So verse 24, let's take a look at that. So in a time of tranquility, he will enter the richest parts of the realm and he will accomplish what his fathers never did, nor his ancestors. He will distribute plunder, booty, and possessions among them, and he will devise his schemes against strongholds, but only for a time. And so Antiochus did show some friendliness to the Egyptian people. He used this to his advantage. He rose to power with kind of the help of smaller groups of people, but he was, you know, historians do acknowledge that he was a genius as far as being, dishonest and exercise, you know, using intrigue to his benefit, and he was just very successful in establishing himself, because he was not the he was not a descendant of like Antiochus the Great. It says that he came to power, but it was not conferred upon him. So it was a way that he got into power that just involved more political maneuvering, I would say, than what you would ordinarily see in the succession of kings. So he lives lavishly, but only for a time. You know, God had decreed an amount of time in which Antiochus would be around, and he certainly troubled the Jews during this time. So there's more conflict going on between Antiochus and the king and Egypt. But in verse 28, let's take a look at this, because we know, you know, you may be more familiar with this. Antiochus is the one that really, really tried to stamp out Judaism, desecrated the temple, did a number of things to really persecute the Jews. So in verse 28, he will return to his own land with much plunder, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant, and he will take action and then return to his own land. So he made several different campaigns down to Egypt, and on his second campaign down into Egypt, which is what's kind of described here, he's coming back, and he's coming back with a bunch of wealth that he was able to acquire during this campaign down into Egypt. So when he returned from Egypt, there had been a revolt within Judea against someone named Menelaus, who was the acting high priest at that time. Menelaus had been actually appointed high priest by Antiochus Epiphanes. So he had been installed by Antiochus. The previous high priest, whose name had been Joshua, he had he had actually, so his father, Onias III, had been high priest, had bribed Antiochus to be high priest. His son Joshua then had been a high priest, but then Antiochus Epiphanes supplanted this Joshua with this person named Menelaus, who had somehow attained the favor of Antiochus. So when this happened, then Joshua, who had been supplanted, he flees. He flees east of the Jordan River. So meanwhile, Menelaus, he begins robbing the temple to pay off a debt that he has to Antiochus Epiphanes. So when Antiochus is down in Egypt, there's a rumor that Antiochus Epiphanes had been killed. And so Joshua hears this rumor and comes with 1,000 men back into Jerusalem to retake the city. However, much to Joshua's chagrin, Antiochus Epiphanes actually came back and saw this this revolt as an attack on Antiochus himself. And so that was when Antiochus then really turned his attention to Judea and really, really tried to stamp out Judaism at this time. And the climax of all of this is really kind of described down in verse 31. So forces from him will arise, desecrate the sanctuary fortress, and do away with the regular sacrifice, and they will set up the abomination of desolation. So he had Antiochus Epiphanes, he had armed forces. They were standing guard over the temple, and on a certain Sabbath day, they attacked the city. They took women and children as prisoners. Houses were overthrown. The citadel was occupied. And Antiochus really tried to just wipe out Judaism in one fell swoop and replace it with Hellenism and pagan, you know, Greek paganism, and went so far as erecting a heathen altar on top of the altar of the burnt offering. And so then, if you ever look at, you know, the writings of Josephus cover some of this, some of the apocryphal books like the First and Second Maccabees, not inspired books, but writings that do cover this period of time, talk a lot about this and this, you know, this time of history and the activities of Antiochus Epiphanes, particularly against the Jews themselves. Okay. Any comments or questions on any of that? Yeah, John. So, yeah, there is this individual Heliodorus that we talked about earlier. So the tax collector, the prime minister, there actually is some archaeological evidence that identifies him by name and his position and fits into this time period. And so it kind of lines up with the events that, you know, that does offer some additional evidence to that. What's that? Well, the prophecy itself is like 6th century BC. And then this is like, I think, 3rd through 1st century BC kind of period. The Romans came to power, I think, in like 135 BC. So it's that, you know, 350 to 250, I think, or 200 kind of time frame that it's fulfilled. Does that make sense? Okay. All right. All right. So with all that, verses 29 and verse 35, let's take a look at this. And I did have a question about this. So verse 29, at the appointed time, he will return and come into the south. But at this last time, it will not turn away. It will not turn out the way it did before. In verse 35, some of those who have insight will fall in order to refine, purge, and make them pure until the end time, because it is still to come at the appointed time. So there's a couple of things in those two verses that I thought were interesting. Anything stand out to you from those two verses without trying to focus in too much in the events themselves? But there's something that's said there in those two verses that I thought stood out a little bit. You can read my mind. Right, right. God is, yeah. And God certainly is using all of this. You know, he's using these kings of the north to bring about his purpose and his plan, for sure. One thing that stood out to me in those two verses is this notion of at the appointed time. So there was an appointed time for these things to happen. God is in control of all of these events. And, you know, he's operating with a timeline. So, you know, verses 5, really all the way down through verse 35, we have all this history that kind of culminates in this Antiochus Epiphanes and in what's going to happen to Daniel's people, to the Jews during this time of history. And then verse 36 is interesting because now in verse 36, there's a king who's introduced and he will do as he pleases. And this is a different king. Get back to that in just a second. Then the king of the north or the king of the south. Because if you look over in verse 40, this king at the end time, the king of the south will collide with him and the king of the north will storm against him with chariots, with horsemen and so forth. So this king introduced now in verse 36 is a different king and one who is actually going to be at odds with both the king of the north and with the king of the south. And we talked a little bit about this word king and how it can be used really not just strictly to talk about an individual person serving as a king, but as a kingdom. We looked over in chapter 7, in fact, where the fourth beast is referred to as both a king and a kingdom in different verses. And so it's consistent within this prophecy that this king introduced in 36 really is a kingdom that comes on the scene now and is going to be interacting with God's people as well and affecting them. So this king generally describes the Roman emperors. And if you read down through these descriptions, you know, they have no regard for the gods of their fathers. They honor a god of fortresses. This king would be helped by a foreign god in verse 39. And that idea is that the Roman Empire really helped by a god foreign to the Roman Empire. So the activities that the Romans were doing to some extent were actually directed by God and used for God's purposes. The emperors didn't know that and, you know, had no recognition of God. But that's, you know, God is helping this empire, this Roman Empire now to accomplish his purposes. All right. So we can look at this for this king. So this king who's introduced now in verse 36 really corresponds back to the previous visions that we've seen. So we think about the Roman Empire and how it has been presented through the book of Daniel. There's this king referred to now in chapter 12 and verse 36 and the activities that are described there in connection with this king. Back in chapter 9 that we looked at, Daniel is told that the people of the prince who is to come would ultimately destroy the sanctuary, destroy the temple, which is foretold there. And we looked back in chapter 7 about that fourth beast and saw how that corresponded as well to the Roman Empire. And then the image that Daniel saw, that Nebuchadnezzar saw, which was interpreted by Daniel also, the legs and the feet of iron and clay. So, you know, there's a lot of detail in this, but it's important, too, to just kind of step back and just see the history that is being revealed to Daniel and even to kings, to Nebuchadnezzar, about what's going to happen and how God is ultimately going to bring about and establish his kingdom in all of this. Then In verse, let's see. Verse 41 of chapter 11. Let's read down through the end. He will also, this is talking now about this king, this Roman Empire. He will enter the beautiful land and many countries will fall, but these will be rescued out of his hand, Edom, Moab, and the foremost of the sons of Ammon. Then he will stretch out his hand against the other countries and the land of Egypt will not escape. So this king is really even more successful than what we had been reading about with the kings of the north and the south. But he will gain control over the hidden treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt, and Libyans and Ethiopians will follow at his heels. But rumors from the east and from the north will disturb him, and he will go forth with great wrath to destroy and annihilate many. He will pitch the tents of his royal pavilion between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain, yet he will come to his end and no one will help him. And so in a very condensed fashion, that talks about the history of the Roman Empire in this area up to at least the time when they destroy the temple. So that was in 70 AD. Titus came in, son of the emperor at that time, Vespasian, did in fact, you know, pitch tents in the land, establish a siege around it. And then we know that the Roman Empire didn't last, right? Just as it was foretold in the other prophecies we've looked at, God brought an end to that one as well, which I think is what's referred to there at the end of verse 45, that, you know, he will come to his end and no one will help him. So that's about all I have to say about chapter 11. Anybody else have anything they'd like to highlight or ask about? Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Bernie. So the vision continues into chapter 12. And let's just look at verse 1 of chapter 12. Now, at that time, Michael, the great prince, who stands guard over the sons of your people, will arise, and there will be a time of distress such as never occurred since there was a nation until that time. And at that time, your people, everyone who is found written in the book, will be rescued. So, just a couple things to look at here. So, we're looking now at the destruction of Jerusalem, and Daniel is being given some information about this, and it starts off with, you know, at that time. So, at that time is this time that verse 45 of 11 just alluded to, when this king would come in to Palestine and would be destroying the temple and the sanctuary. But so there would be a time of distress such as never occurred since there was a nation. We had looked at this also described back in chapter 9. We mentioned this a few minutes ago, as the people of the prince who is to come, coming and destroying the city and the sanctuary, and all fulfilled by Titus. So there's mention here in chapter 12, verse 1, those who are written in the book. And what does it say about those who are written in the book? What's that? Okay, yeah, they shall be delivered, or they shall be rescued. And then if we look, you know, this is really consistent with, and we talked about this last week a little bit, but in the 24th chapter of Matthew, Jesus gives information as well about the oncoming destruction of the temple in particular. And he makes a statement that the one who endures to the end will be saved, and gives information to his followers. And so really those following Jesus and Jesus' teachings and Jesus' warnings, I think, describe those that in chapter 12, verse 1 of Daniel are those who are written in the book and who would be rescued, at least from this this oncoming destruction of Jerusalem. There's some information given in Malachi, the third chapter, too, where there's a book of remembrance that is referred to with a similar idea there about, you know, those who fear the Lord and who are written in the book of remembrance would be preserved or saved. All right. So let's talk about, in chapter 12, there's reference to many and there's reference to others. So in chapter 2, it says, many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake, these to everlasting life, but the others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. And so there are many who would awake to everlasting life. This, you know, seems, this is a reference not to, you know, the end of time, but really to those to whom, you know, they would hear the gospel. They would hear the gospel preached. So it's similar, I think, to the prophecy in Ezekiel about the valley of the dry bones and being resurrected. It's a spiritual resurrection. And verse 10, the many also would be purged, purified, and refined. There are others, though, who will awake. They will hear the gospel, but you know, as you read through the accounts of the life of Christ and the teachings, his teachings and the teachings of the apostles, that there were many who turned away. They heard it, but they did not. They didn't believe it. They didn't obey it. They didn't follow it. So those would be the others who awake, but they awake to who disgrace and to everlasting contempt. And in John chapter 5, there's a description of this same spiritual resurrection. Jesus describes that and makes the statement, those who hear will live. So then in chapter 12, there is description then of those who have insight and lead many to righteousness. Verse 3, those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven, and those who lead the many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. There's other passages that have this idea of light and insight. Isaiah chapter 62 talks about the coming of the gospel and describes it as light shining in darkness. Jesus in his teachings, his Sermon on the Mount, talks about his followers, those who are citizens of this kingdom would be lights of the world. In Philippians chapter 2, similar teaching there that we are to be lights in the world. And so I think this describes those who are in this spiritual resurrection. We hear the gospel and we are given everlasting life, spiritual life. So then coming into the end of this, there is a question that's asked of the one who is dressed in linen, who Daniel has seen in this vision. And the question is, how long will it be until the end of these wonders? And that answer that's given is a time, times, and half a time. So that's a period of time that we've looked at before. It's a finite amount of time. It's a time in which there would be this distress and tribulation against Daniel's people. So all of this goes back to chapter 10 and verse 14 that we looked at earlier, that all of this is describing what was going to take place really with the Jews. And then there's some references to some periods of time, 1,290 days, 1,330 or 55 days, and really just the blessing of enduring to the end, those that would, you know, endure through persecution, tribulation would be those who would endure, who would have everlasting life, and not be a part of the destruction that is foretold. So there's a lot of information that is given there, and I think, you know, as far as a practical kind of application from all of that, I really think it's just the fact that this is such a very specific prophecy. And it just matches up so well with the, you know, the known history of that period of time and corresponds with, you know, the destruction of the temple. And really, it is the capstone of everything that we've seen through the book of Daniel, the prophecy of the coming kingdom of heaven that God would establish. It would fill the whole world. It would last forever, in contrast to these other worldly kingdoms, which even though God was using for his purpose, each of those came to an end. But those who endure, those who, you know, follow the Messiah, would be those in that everlasting kingdom. Even the Jewish nation itself is going to be brought to an end. There's going to come a time, 70 AD, when the temple is destroyed, and really there's no longer a Jewish nation. The Jewish nation, as such, is no longer God's people. Now God's people are those who are within the kingdom of heaven, which he has established under the Messiah. Any comments or questions about that? And anything from the entire book of Daniel that we want to talk about in the last couple of minutes, in, you know, kind of bringing it back to our lens of Proverbs chapter 3 and verses 5 through 6, you know, trusting in the Lord with all our heart. We've tried to kind of look at this each week as we've gone through different parts of Daniel. Ordinarily, I like the classes to be a little more interactive than this, but this was kind of a lot of detailed information presented in these couple of chapters. Any comments on... At the very end, none that I've been able to find, none that I can find corresponding to anything. They're finite periods of time. Again, verse 11, from the time that the regular sacrifice is abolished and the abomination of desolation is set up, there will be 1,290 days. I don't know that number of days really pertains to anything, but that there would be an end. There would be an end to it. And then how blessed is he who keeps waiting and attains to the 1,335 days. The way I look at that is that's something that lasts beyond the destruction of the temple. So those in the kingdom are blessed. And we know from history that those who heard Jesus's warnings about, you know, what to recognize about the destruction of the temple and of Jerusalem, they got out of Jerusalem. And so there were Christians, there were followers of Christ who saw what was coming, and they took Jesus' advice and teachings, and they did survive past that. I don't know if that's what that's referring to. It has nothing to do with the number of days per se, except that it's a longer period of time than the other number. If anyone else has any ideas on those numbers, I'm certainly open to that. No? Well, we're actually a couple minutes over. Thank you, everybody.